Just a reminder tonight, the new member service, that's really important to us. Just to really welcome people, I'm also going to continue on a topic that Fred started off talking about, the whole concept of relationship. How does a relationship look like in terms of loyalty? And just going to continue with that for tonight. But this morning, we're looking at the book of Mark. And I must say, both of all this morning and tonight, we've got difficult passages we look at. But normally, the passages that's a slight bit tricky, those are the ones we should really look at. I find that in the Bible, if you read something very comfortably, that's not the one you should look at. Isn't it funny? The verses we memorize are all the ones we find very comfortable. Yes, I can do with that verse. I will stick that verse on my steering wheel, look down at it in traffic. You know, those sort of verses are normally not the verses we need. The ones we need is the tricky ones. So this morning and tonight, we're going to look at a couple of tricky ones. But the one this morning talks about the death of John the Baptist, right? So awkward topic. So let's look at it. And King Herod heard of it. This is not Herod the Great. This is Herod Antipas, which was the Tephnarch, they called it, of Galilee. For his name has become well known. This is now Jesus. And people were saying, John the Baptist has arisen from the dead. I mean, this guy is miraculous. He can do amazing things. This must be John the Baptist. Something has happened here. He's raised from the dead. And that is why these miraculous powers are at work in him. But others were saying he is Elijah, and others were saying he's a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. We're going to read a couple of verses. But when Herod heard of it, he kept saying, John, whom I beheaded, has risen. And you can see the anxiety there. You can feel the fear. It's palpable. I've done something I cannot undo. I'm in a heap of trouble here. I don't know if it's John the Baptist, but what if it is? All right? So guilty conscience at work. And I'm pretty sure you haven't beheaded anyone yet. And hopefully in traffic we won't get around to it. So we're not quite the same as Herod and Tippus today, but there's something here of a guilty conscience, isn't there? We've all had this feeling of, oh my goodness, is my past catching up with me? What have I done? It's come back to haunt me here. All right, John, whom I beheaded, is risen. For Herod himself had sinned and had John arrested. We'll get to that again. And bound him in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip, because he had married her. For John had been saying to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Herodias had a grudge against him, which is now the wife. Always a mistake to have a wife have a grudge against you. And wanted to put him to death and could not do so. For Herod was afraid of John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man. We'll come back to that. And he kept him safe. And when he heard him, I was very perplexed. But he used to enjoy listening to him. Now, this is a man very much caught in two worlds. On one hand, he's perplexed, he's challenged. But on the other hand, he wanted to listen to him. A strategic day came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a banquet for his lords and military commanders and the leading men of Galilee. And when the daughter of Herodias herself came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his dinner guests. All right, that is a very polite language for what happened there. And the king said to the girl, ask me for whatever you want, and I will give it to you. And he said to her, whatever you ask of me, I will give it to you up to half of my kingdom. And she went out and said to her mother, what shall I ask for? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. Immediately, she came in a hurry. I mean, how's that for listening to your mum? Immediately, she came in a hurry to the king and said, and asked, saying, if I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And although the king was very sorry, yet because of his oaths and because of his dinner guests, he was unwilling to refuse. Immediately, the king sent the executioner and commanded him to bring back his head. And he went and had him beheaded in the prison. And he brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. When his disciples heard about this, they came and took away his body and laid it in the tomb. The apostles gathered together with Jesus, and they reported to him all that they had done and taught. He said to them, come away by yourselves to a secluded place and rest a while. For there were many people coming and going that did not even have time to eat. They went away in a boat to a secluded place by themselves. So, in the context here, this is a portion of the book of Mark, where things are starting to get a bit awkward, to be honest. And this story is inserted right there. This is something that happened earlier. But it's inserted right there because the author, Mark, he wants to demonstrate something by the Holy Spirit, and that is that we have a struggle between the righteous and the unrighteous. In the end of the day, we have to realize that in this life, there is only one, two categories. There's the righteous and there's the unrighteous. And this is the story exactly of the righteous and the unrighteous. And now, this is where it gets very awkward. Because in the context of what it's telling here is that Jesus was, up to that stage, very much loved, very much appreciated. Crowds came, crowds went. People wanted to be around him, but now something started happening. People were rejecting him. Crowds were rejecting him. Leaders were rejecting him. The same things was happening to his followers. Now, John the Baptist, we know, was called, among other things, a forerunner of Jesus Christ. Which is to say that he did prepare a way for Jesus, but also what happened to him was what happened to Jesus Christ. He became an example and a type of Jesus. And in other words, we're already getting a foreboding sense here. We, of course, know what happened to Jesus in the end. He was crucified, but of course he was resurrected. But John the Baptist was the first one to be killed there. And we get a sense that the same thing is on its way happening to Jesus. And this, of course, is not something nice for us to hear. Because here's the thing, the take-home message, and that is there's a price to righteousness. In reality, most of the times, what we'd say is that, you know, if you're righteous, if you do the right things, and you have a right relationship with God and with people, that's what righteousness means, you will have a good life. All right? That is a take-home message normally, right? And yes, in a sense, that is true, but it does not take an account that in this world there is a struggle of epic proportions between good and evil. And that is not something we will get around. Reality is that there is daily a battle, not just for your own soul, but for the souls of those around you. There is a war. And Jesus demonstrates this to us. If Jesus was treated the way he truly ought to be treated, he never would have been crucified. He would have been Caesar, if I could put it that way. Because people would have recognized this man's immense, immense righteousness. They would have said there was never anyone who lived like this. In fact, people did say that, and then they crucified him. For doing the right thing, you will at times pay a price for that. And you must make a peace with that. You must make a peace with that. And if this earth was all that there was, that would sound very unfair. But in reality, it's not. Because we live for inkling our eye here. More than that, though. And that is that what is truly yours in the end of the day is your character. What is truly yours in the end of the day is your character. Not your bank balance, not the degrees that you got, not the things that you have. Those things, it comes and it goes, but what is truly yours is your character. And your character is all about the choices you make. And this story is very instructive because it's a story about two men. Two categories of men. Two men at the opposite ends of the spectrum. When we read the story of these two men, I mean, it is quite obvious that John the Baptist is an uncompromisingly righteous man. But when we read the story, it almost feels like a sympathy is somewhat with Herod. We don't like what he did. We don't agree with what he did. But there's a bit of a sympathy for him. Can you not feel it? I mean, we read the story, we see that he's a conflicted man. We see that he's haunted by his past. And maybe there's something in us that says, yes, I can relate to that. We read his story, we see that on the one hand, he really wants to respond to what John the Baptist is saying. But we see on the other hand, he is conflicted by his circumstances and the pressure other people put on him. And maybe you can say, well, I can relate to that. Then we see in a moment of weakness, he does something that he cannot undo and it really bothers him for the rest of his life. And maybe, again, we can relate to it. We cannot relate with what he did, but perhaps we can relate to him as a person. And why I'm saying this to you is because in the end of the day, it's not good enough to say that my intention was good. It's not good enough to say, you know what, these are the things that I said, these are the things I believe. Because in the end of the day, what you do is what really matters. And in our society, we're more consumed of how we feel about something than what we actually did. Our favorite excuse is to say, I didn't mean that. And that's great, but you still did it. And that's a problem. What we do in the end of the day is more important than what we feel about it. I'm not saying what we feel is not important at all. Of course it is important. Our motive certainly is very important. But what you do is truly, truly what is in the end of the day going to determine who you are and where you go. If we can just skip a slide, just go on. I found this quote from Margaret Thatcher of all people. And I love this quote. Look at this quote. Watch your thoughts, for they become words. Watch your words, for they become actions. Watch your actions, for they become habits. Watch your habits, for they become your character. And watch your character, for it becomes your destiny. And I thought, boy, that is really well put by the Iron Lady herself. So let's go back one slide, and let's look at the difference between the two. What was the nature of Herod? What is the nature of John? And I want to take you a bit more back into the scenario of what happened there. Now, we all know the story of John the Baptist. We all know the story of Herod Antipas. But let's dig a bit deeper in the situation and the circumstances then. The Herods were very much new kings to this area. In fact, initially they weren't Jewish. They were Edomian, which means they came from Edom. Edom, at that stage, just a couple of centuries ago, was actually conquered by the Hasmoneans, which was a line of kings. And they become incorporated into the Jewish culture. Initially, they weren't Jewish, but they adopted a Jewish character. Now, the Romans, when they came into this area and they took control of this area, they typically did three things. That was their sort of modus operandi. Wherever they went, the Romans would do three things. First, they would demonstrate their military might. They believed in the end of the day, if you wanted peace, if you wanted control, you had to demonstrate your might. And that they did very efficiently in this area as well. The second thing that they would do is that they would institute a tribute, which is extraction of money, a tax that they would lay on the people. And taxation was exceptionally steep at that time. Probably anything between 30 and 50% of people's income went for taxation. And it was a subsistence economy, which meant people didn't have a lot. All right. The third thing that they would do, the Romans, is that they would rule through a local elite. Now, in this sense, the Romans, these guys were clever. They were devious, but they were certainly very clever in what they did. And their argument was very simple. What is the most efficient way to rule in a territory that is not really your own, that you conquered? And they argued to themselves, you know what, if we put down directly a king or a governor that is Roman, it might not work that efficiently. Rather, what we're going to do is we're going to take local people. People that's already reckoned as the elite there. And what we're going to do is we're going to rule through them. And because of their political connection, because of their local connection, these guys will be far more efficient. But you know what? They're going to be very much loyal to us. Now, Roman Palestine in Judea at that stage, that didn't work that well because here was a problem. There wasn't a local elite. The Hasmoneans, they weren't particularly reliable. They were revolting all the time. They couldn't work through them. So what did they do? They appointed the Herods. And the Herods had this concept down to a T. They were the best political operators of their time. Their power was very simply derived from one concept, and that is the concept of patronage. Now, in that days, you didn't have a democracy. You didn't put your face on a ballot, and people went like, ta-ta, I vote for you. All right, didn't happen. You didn't have a large bureaucracy. You didn't have home affairs. You didn't have all kinds of bureaucracies, all kinds of lines. How did it work in those days? Power was simply derived from personal relationship. That is called patronage. Caesar would go and he would personally, through a personal relationship, appoint governors and rulers in every one of his territories. You were appointed to power because you had a relationship. And that relationship was a relationship of power and subservience. And here, the Herods were really great at. In fact, they were such smooth operators that Herod the Great survived three Caesars, three emperors. In the civil war, he backed the wrong one. He backed Antony, and we know that Antony lost. He lost of Cleopatra at the Battle of Actium in Egypt. And this guy immediately jumped on his horse, a couple of horses, went over, begged Octavius, so it became August. And August actually made him again the ruler in Judea. These guys were very good with it, but what it meant was that your leash was very short. Because in the end of the day, you weren't judged as a ruler because you were particularly good for your people. You weren't judged as a ruler because you were efficient at what you did. You were judged as a ruler because you promoted the interest of the one that you had a relationship with. That's called patronage. And in fact, the Jewish people hated the Herods. It can be argued that the Herods was the most successful kings in the history of Judea. The amount of wealth that they generated was astounding. The buildings that they did was astounding. Their reach was astounding. In fact, their wealth was such great measure that Herod would actually build buildings even as far as Athens. This guy was exceptionally wealthy, and his son tried to emulate him. Now, Jewish people hated them. When Herod died, he effectively ran a police state. He had foreigners, that was his military. You couldn't gather after hours in meetings. He abolished all the Jewish governing bodies. He effectively ran a police state. And when he died in 4 BC, the Jewish people rose in revolt against him. One of the main cities that rose was Sepphoris, which was about 4 kilometers away from where Jesus grew up in Nazareth. The Romans came in, Varus was the guy's name, the commander that came in, but crucified 2,000 people from Sepphoris alone. Yes, but that was a music to indicate the tenseness of the situation. Thank you for helping me there. So these guys were hated. And his son was hated as much. His capital city that he built, Tiberias, in Galilee, Herod Antipas, he ruled over Galilee. Only Herod the Great had a larger area that he ruled over. The capital city that he built, Tiberias, where did he build it? On the amazing location of a graveyard. Which, of course, in those days, you couldn't be Jewish and go to a graveyard without being ritually impure. So people wouldn't go there. This guy was hated. But he tried to emulate his father's way of rule, which was by patronage. That's why he called the capital city that he built Tiberias, he called after, well, guess what? The Caesar, Tiberias. Because he wanted to honor him. But now here's the thing. The same thing that he would do to have power from Caesar, he would do to others. In other words, other people became his clients, and he became their patronage. And here we have a scene which is typically a scene of patronage. What would happen with patronage is that every day, your client, which is one who serves you, and you give to them certain things because you have a power to give it to them, and they commit to you their loyalty. A patron would every day receive his clients, and his clients would come and greet the patrons every day. Thank you. Just to make sure that relationship is intact. All right? And typically what they would do is have banquets where all the clients would come to the patron. And this is the scene. On his birthday, he has this banquet. All his clients come. We have this lewd scene where his daughter-in-law, is that the right way of putting it? Stepdaughter, yes. She's dancing, and we're not talking about doing ballet here, I'm pretty sure. Okay? And this guy shoots off his mouth because he's not thinking. Because he's probably drunk, he's lewd, he says, I'll give you anything. And then she asks one thing. And now this guy is in a precarious position. Because he's got all his clients with him, all the people that admire him, all the people that go like, you are like a god. You are Herod Antipas. Alright? We know, I can't quite remember if it was Herod Antipas or whether, I think it was actually him. The Bible records that he died. He was eaten by worms. Nilas, help me. Was this the same guy, Herod Antipas? One of the Herods. I think it might be him. Alright? I'm not going to put my head on a block and embarrass myself here.
I think it was him, but people came and said, he is like a god. And then God struck him down. And that is exactly the scenario. All his clients, all the people that look at him and go like, you are my source of power. And now this girl asks us one thing and he cannot deny it, because if he denies it, he loses face. He loses honor. He loses a sense of these guys admiring him because he's going back on his word. He's painted himself in the corner. And here's the thing, he doesn't have a character, because the issue for him was never character. The issue for him is power. Now, look at the reverse of that. John the Baptist. John the Baptist is very different from this guy. John the Baptist, Jesus called the greatest prophet of the Old Testament, and he's very much in the mold of the Old Testament prophets. And for that, we just have to stop here for a moment. I hope I'm not boring you yet, Peter, but let's just stop here for a moment and look at the unique system that the Israelites had. When they came into the Promised Land, they did something that was very much unheard of in those days. In those days, if you formed a nation and you got a monarch, you would have absolute power. You had absolute power to the sense that you were the military commander, you were the head of state, and you were the high priest. You were seen as divine. The Romans did that, of course, as well. The Caesar had within himself the power of state. He was a high priest. He was declared a god, a son of a god. It meant you had religious power. It meant you had political power. It meant you had absolute economic power. You were absolute in absolute everything. All power of state was invested in one person, and that person was seen as divine. And the Israelites were very different. It was a marvel what they did. The first thing that they did when they entered the Promised Land was the understanding that everyone had their own land. And this right to this land was so inalienable that you couldn't take it away. They had something called the Jubilee. Every 7 years, they had the Jubilee. In the Jubilee, the land had to rest, but also every bit of debt was written off. If you were indebted and you became a slave because you couldn't pay your debt, they had to release you after 7 years. If your land was taken because you lost everything, they had to restore your land, because the right to your land could not be lost. And no one could take that away. What is the worst king in the history of Israel? Probably Ahab. People hated him. He did many things wrong. What was the thing that tipped the edge when he took the vineyard of Naboth? If you go and you read the prophets, they always stand up and they talk about the abuse of the kings against the poor. Because the understanding for the Israelites, and this is what makes Israel very unique in that time, was that the king did not have absolute power. God had absolute power. Everything belonged to God. And if everything belonged to God, it meant that everything that was used had to be used according to the character of God. And God is a just God. He's an equitable God. He's not an oppressive God. And therefore, people had to be treated right. And the kings were only stewards of that, and the prophets would remind them. And this is exactly what John the Baptist did. If you go and you read what John the Baptist said, he spoke about repentance in a moral sense, but he also spoke about how do we use our resources. He would say to the tax collectors, do not collect more than what is your right. Do not take what is not yours. And now he comes and he speaks against Herod. What Herod Antipas does, he married his brother's wife. Why? Herodias. Herodias was politically connected. She was still part of her Simonian line. So by marrying her, he gave himself more political power. Now, John the Baptist didn't care about his political power, because he said, according to law, what you do is wrong. You see, the difference between John the Baptist and Herod Antipas is this. Herod Antipas is all about getting ahead in life. John the Baptist is all about what is right. So this clash is inevitable, because John the Baptist had so much influence But it couldn't be ignored anymore. So now here the problem starts for Herod Antipas, because now he has to take this guy and he has to imprison him because this guy is pointing out his moral failures and he cannot afford that. So he takes him in, but still he wants to listen to him. But now he's driven in a corner on one evening. And he makes decisions, and his decisions he consistently make to get ahead in life. And I think there's much for us to learn here. You see, every day we make choices. Every day we become like a Herod Antipas, or we become like a John the Baptist. And the scary thing about life is, I think the more I go on in life, not that I'm that old, but the more I go on in life, and the more I experience of life, I come to realize that people can either do amazing things or terrible things I never imagined. You see, we've got this weird saying of, you know, I'm a good person. They're a good person. But that's not the point. The point is, within ourselves, we have the potential of, by the grace of God, becoming like Christ. Or we have a potential to do truly evil things like Herod Antipas. The question is, what is the basis of our lives? And John the Baptist had one basis, and that is to be uncompromisingly righteous. And this guy did go to the X factor, the nth degree. This is a guy that wore camel hair on the clothes. Camel hair Gucci. This is a guy that went to Spur and ordered locust with no honey, please. All right? This is a guy with a wild hair. All right? He would have done well in Cape Town, I think. All right? He had wild hair. This is a guy that goes to the nth degree. In fact, he goes so far that we go like, whoa, you're freaking me out, dude. You see, I would pose to you that most of us can relate easier to Herod Antipas than what we can relate to John the Baptist. And I would pose to you, it's because all of us are tempted to take the route of Herod Antipas, which is do whatever it takes to get ahead in life, because that is the world we live in. I'm sure Herod Antipas said to him, listen, hey, I don't have a choice. The Romans, they're all powerful. If I don't do things in a certain way, it's my head. And it's better to have my head than, you know, for him to lose his head. Let him lose his head. I'll keep my head. I'm sure he gave a lot of excuses. I'm sure he said, look, I don't have a choice now. I'm punted in the corner. I'm going to lose honor. These guys are not going to be my clients anymore. I'm going to lose my power base. The Jewish people already hate me. If I lose my power base here because I go back on my promises, I'm in trouble. I'm sure he could have rationalized it in many different ways. And I'm sure because of that, we tend to relate to him because that is the world that we live in. But what we have to remember is that we all base our lives on something. Question is, what do I base my life on today? Do I base my life on pragmatism? Whatever I need to get ahead. Do I base my life on what is right and wrong? See, my argument would be, either way, there's a price to pay. For righteousness, for doing the right thing, even if it's unpopular. I mean, we've got to give this guy credit for some guts. Going to the guy that can kill you without thinking about it and say, listen, I just want to say to you, what the heck were you thinking? You can't marry that wife. I mean, this takes some guts. And there's consequences to it. This guy was uncompromisingly righteous. For everything, there's a price. For righteousness, there's a price because you will be opposed from time to time. Oh, yes. Let me just say this. This might not be too popular, but I'm just going to say it. Now, we should not buy into the culture that says that tolerance is more important than doing what is right. Tolerance is important because it's important to love people. But it's more important to do what is right. Because you know what? Other people suffer when wrong things are done. And by not doing anything when wrong are done, it means we don't love people. It means we just love the person that does wrong. But we don't love a victim. So there is a price to pay, and we must make peace with that. If you do the right thing, people are going to say things to you. Because they're going to be intimidated by that. Because Harrison Tippett was intimidated by John the Baptist. On the other hand, if you do what is pragmatic, Harrison Tippett, he did quite well in life, economically speaking, politically speaking. But here's the thing. He lived in torment. Because he was waiting for his past to catch up with him. And you know what? I'd rather lose my head than live in fear all the time. I'd rather be embraced into eternity than I'm worrying all the time for whatever ghost is going to catch me. Okay, that sounds a bit harsh. I'm sure for most of us, that's not going to be the decision one day, lose my head or not. The question is, what price is you willing to pay? What is the price that you're willing to pay? And all of us make choices for that. You see, I see from time to time, I see people walk away from God. And they don't walk away from God because they stop believing. Because they do not confess Christ anymore. They walk away from God because of the choices they make. Moral choices. Your character is the most important virtue you have. It's the greatest asset you have. It's the most precious asset that you can build up. Do it well. I'm not saying this to evoke guilt in us today. Say, look at ourselves and say, hey, I'm a failure. I'm not doing that. What I'm doing, though, is just pointing out the obvious. And the obvious is this. All of us base our lives on something. What is it that you base your life really on today? And your character will show you what it is you're actually basing your life on. And make decisions about that. Make decisions about that. That is what is important. Let's just stand this morning. Let's bring ourselves before God. Let's close our eyes and let's bring our hearts before God. Father, we recognize that life can be hard sometimes. All of us has been in positions where we've made choices that we look back on and we go like, oh my goodness, why did I make that choice? All of us have moments of weakness, a Harrison Tippett sort of moment where we're caught with our pants down, metaphorically speaking. And what now? Lord, we thank you that you are a God of forgiveness and repentance. There's always another chance of you. There's always a place where we can make right. But then the question becomes, what do I base my life on? And Lord, we must confess we are so influenced every day just by the abundance of wealth around us, the way things are done, the game that is played politically, where we work, in our families even perhaps. And we're so tempted to be the Harrison Tippett, to do what it takes to get ahead, because no one else will look after me. But Lord, then today we come back to the honest truth of character. That character does matter. That it does determine our destiny. And therefore we ask for the grace today to be conformed to the image of Christ. We ask for grace today not to abandon, not to abolish the moral law, but to fulfill it. We ask for the grace today in that moment of weakness that we know that you are with us. Your rod and your staff, it guides us. You will never leave us. You will never forsake us. You're always with us. You always give the way forward to us. And we come to rely upon that today. And Lord, then we thank you that all of us, no matter who we are, no matter what has been in our lives, no matter what has transpired in our lives, we can today embrace the blessing of a clear conscience before God. Give us clean hands. Give us a pure heart. Let our soul not bow to another. That is our prayer today. And thank you that we can embrace righteousness. Let your name be glorified. I'm just going to give you a moment too, if you just, while we keep our eyes closed, if you just want to speak to God where you are, and just bring your situation before God. Let's just give a moment or two of silence for that.